From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, we'll hear about some water resource management strategies which took place at the annual Governmental Research Association conference. Then, a journalist and first-time mother finds herself unable to breastfeed and is judged for it. And our dining critic defends the right of women to breastfeed in public.
We're not talking about witnessing, you know, some kind of indecent act. This is not an indecent act. So, to me, it's kind of ludicrous to be offended by it.
The Boulevard Theater opens the comedy Tigers Be Still, and the band The Please Please Me want you to feel free to shake it as hard as you like.
We really try and create that on stage by making this just really expressive, really sexual, really alive environment where everybody is invited.
Stay tuned for Lake Effect on WUWM after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. This week, Milwaukee's Public Policy Forum played host to government researchers from across the country. They're members of a national organization dating back to 1914 called the Governmental Research Association. Every year it holds a conference, and this year it took place in Milwaukee. During their time here, the researchers are reflecting on everything from education standards to pension and health care reform. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz slipped into a panel discussion entitled The Latest in Water Resource Management Strategies and Activities, Green Infrastructure and Inclusive Project Planning, whether inside or beyond the Great Lakes Basin, dominated the conversation.
Not so long ago, the topic that attracted a conference room full of government researchers might have been titled The Latest in Wastewater Management. Kevin Schaefer says those days are over. He's executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. As the conference host city, Schaefer had the chance to toot MMSD's horn. He says sustainability started long before he came on the scene in 2002. In the 1920s, Milwaukee came up with a way to package and sell the solids left in the treatment process.
Now, we used to call it sludge, which was just a terrible term. So now we call it biosolids. It sounds so much better. And since 1926, Milwaukee has been producing a fertilizer for your lawns called Milorganite, Milwaukee Organic Nitrate.
Schaefer admits business at the city's sewage treatment plants has not always been so rosy. Until its massive deep tunnel system was installed, the city was plagued by repeated basement backups and overflows during not even so major storm events.
In Milwaukee, I should add, we had a lawsuit in late 1970s that drove Milwaukee to the deep tunnel system.
Today, Milwaukee sees light at the end of the tunnel. It has not only dramatically reduced storm overflow incidents, but the sewerage district and partner groups are reaching upstream to try to reduce polluting runoff. MMSD has also set out to achieve a high-bar sustainability plan. Panelist Brian Jensen says right now, the sprawling Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania sewerage system has no time to contemplate such lofty goals. He's with the Allegheny Conference on Community Development and says Pittsburgh is under EPA mandate to eliminate sanitary sewer overflows and drastically reduce spillovers at the combined sanitary and storm sewer level. Jensen calls it a daunting $3.6 billion task for a city struggling to reimagine its economic future.
We're under a consent decree to finish all of our work by 2026. It's not a very long period of time that we have to deal with these issues. And again, since we have such a variety of organizations and agencies involved in this, 83 municipalities, the County Health Department, the Department of Environmental Protection, the state level, and the EPA, we've got a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of work to do until we get to the point that we're in compliance.
David Ulrich shifted the discussion from Pittsburgh's challenges back to the Great Lakes. He represents a consortium of over 100 cities bordering the water bodies and says their list of concerns begins with the letter A, the threat of Asian carp.
Another situation up just on Lake Huron, Kincardine, Ontario, they're proposing a deep geologic repository 1 kilometer from the shore of Lake Huron for low and intermediate radioactive waste. That's something that affects, you know, the entire Great Lakes and the St. Lawrence. And I think we've got to figure out ways to look at these things where the political boundaries, whether it's national, state, provincial, city, county, whatever, become less significant. And the natural features define where collaboration ought to be occurring, an area of an effect, if you will. So this may be revolutionary or heretical or something like that, but I just think we got to get better at it.
The sheer abundance of Great Lakes water left one audience member from an unnamed western state astounded. He says where he comes from, capturing rainwater in barrels would be illegal because it would impact somebody else's water rights downstream. He asked MMSD's Kevin Schaefer, does Milwaukee have any issues around water rights?
No.
I think in general, we've been kind of viewed as a water-rich region.
EPA stormwater specialist Bob Newport stepped in to add context.
And we're trying to sort of mimic the natural hydrology. When we talk about green infrastructure, it's like, well, what would happen in a natural condition if we didn't have these parking lots? And we capture that water in a rain garden, and the same amount of water soaks in as would have happened if the parking lot was never there to begin with. And so when you have that thought of like we're just mimicking the natural condition, then we don't encounter those kinds of things. But we also don't have the relative shortage of water, so the water rights laws are just not in effect in these states, in the Northeast and Midwest, like you see in the western states.
Even though there aren't disputes, I think, over capturing water, there's a lot of attention to diverting water.
That's David Ulrich with the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative.
And that water quantity issue is big time right now because of the low lake levels, particularly in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron.
One of the issues that we're dealing with,
Brian Jensen from Pittsburgh jumps in,
our Ohio River Sanitary group, they are very concerned about the potential for diverting water from the Ohio River Basin down to the Tennessee Valley area. We don't have the authority yet to keep those kinds of divertments from happening, but it is on our minds. Even though we do have an abundance of water, we want to make sure that we continue to keep that abundance.
A universal question popped up that applies to the water rich and water poor alike. How do you come up with the breathtaking sums required to pull off water resource management projects? MMSD's Kevin Schaefer's advice? You have to be able to tie it to economic benefits.
To economic improvements, to public health and safety improvements. I think those are some of the big themes. And then, of course, you always tie the word jobs because everyone wants to say, oh, there's jobs, jobs, jobs. You know, talk about jobs. So it's that economic piece that I think is really the biggest seller for some of these things.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
The annual conference of the Governmental Research Association wraps up today in Milwaukee. A writer tries to diffuse some of the strident tone in the debate over breastfeeding. We'll speak with her next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. When we hear the phrase a woman's right to choose, you'd think we were referring to the hot-button issue of abortion. But journalist and blogger Suzanne Barston says increasingly the new battle lines are over breastfeeding. A new study published yesterday in the journal JAMA Pediatrics says babies who are breastfed are smarter, scoring higher on intelligence tests. The study is likely to throw even more fuel on the fire in the breastfeeding debate. After Barston's first son was born, she wanted to breastfeed, but her son couldn't latch on and was allergic to her milk, despite doctors saying that wasn't possible. Barston tried changing her diet to no avail and finally reluctantly resorted to hypoallergenic formula, and her son thrived. Barston relates her experience and the political debate she wasn't prepared for in her book, Bottled Up, How the Way We Feed Babies Has Come to Define Motherhood and Why It Shouldn't. She spoke with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce in May and said that many mothers can't or simply don't want to breastfeed, but the growing lactivist movement often makes them feel like failures as mothers, as Barston did at first.
the thought of trying it again, of going back to formula, just seemed like ultimate failure. And, you know, everything I read, I kept Googling, and everything said, you know, just keep up with it. There's no way a baby can be allergic to breast milk. There's no way breast milk is the best thing for a child who is allergic. So, you know, in my mind, I thought that was the last thing we should do is try formula. And it wasn't until, you know, a specialist said to me, this is what we need to try. And if it works, then, you know, we can look at our options and see if there's something you can do to keep breastfeeding. That kind of gave me permission to try it. And I never really looked back, because once I saw what a difference it was making, it was just clear to me that, you know, I had been letting dogma in the way of what was really best for my child.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that dogma. How did, as a culture, we get into this kind of breastfeeding frenzy when just a few decades ago we were a primarily bottle feeding nation?
Well, interestingly, we're actually still, well, I wouldn't say primarily. We're about a 50% bottle feeding nation at this point. Breastfeeding rates are going up. Unfortunately, long-term breastfeeding rates are not. But, you know, within the first 6 months, almost half of us are breastfeeding. Even if it's not exclusive, we're at least primarily breastfeeding. But the way we got into this was, like you said, we were a predominantly bottle feeding society for a long time. And the reason this was is because the pediatric community had managed to convince women that their milk was not the best thing for their baby. Formula in the 50s and 60s was seen as this, you know, technological, advanced, wonderful thing that was going to provide, you know, better nutrition than Mother Nature could. And then what happened was there was a scandal in the 70s with the Nestle Corporation. And they went into Africa and basically convinced women the same thing that they were telling them here, that their breast milk was not sufficient, convinced them to use formula, left the country, and left these women in a situation where they had no access to formula, they had no access to clean water, and the results were horrific. Tons of babies died. It was a really terrible situation. Well, back here and in other Western nations, people started getting really rightfully upset about this. But instead of making it into an issue of, you know, corporate greed and misconduct, what happened was people in the medical community who felt like this was a morally wrong thing to do, which they were right, took it upon themselves to start looking into the health effects of formula and figured that if they could make a case that formula was bad for you, that they could really take down the formula companies. So we saw a slew of studies come out around then that were showing that breastfeeding was better for babies than formula. So this has continued because we have science that supposedly shows that there's these immense benefits. Politicians have signed on. There's been a large push within, you know, the feminist community to sort of take back the breast and make breastfeeding a feminist issue as well. So we have all these forces sort of converging and making breastfeeding a public health and a political and a feminist issue. And that's how we ended up where we were.
But what does the science actually show? I mean, you go into that in great detail in the book, showing that, you know, not all of the science is, I don't want to say is there, but it's been maybe interpreted in the wrong way by some of the so-called lactivists.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. You know, it's a tricky situation because the last thing I would ever want to do is suggest that breastfeeding isn't good for babies. It is. It clearly is. However, I think that the studies that we do have, well, first of all, we need to understand that they're mostly associative. So they're not taking two groups of babies and saying, okay, we're going to blindly assign half of you to formula feed and half of you to breastfeed, and we're going to watch the outcomes. Obviously, that's not ethical. So what we have instead is observational studies. So we'll look at what happens to babies who are exclusively breastfed in the long term versus babies who are exclusively formula fed. Problem is, there are fundamental differences between the families who are exclusively breastfeeding and those that are exclusively bottle feeding. Obviously, there's socioeconomic differences, but even beyond that, there's just some very intangible differences between the mothers who are doing both these sorts of feeding. And also you have to factor in why that baby is being bottle fed in the first place, because if there were health issues that contributed to breastfeeding failure, that may also play into health issues later on in that child's life. So anyway, you have these flaws in the studies. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is, even when the studies are as strong as we can possibly hope that they are, so for instance, sibling studies that look at children within the same family when one is breastfed and one is formula fed, which is sort of taking out some of these what they call confounding factors. Even in those, you know, we can see some statistical differences that are significant statistically. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're really significant in the lives of everyday women who live in areas with clean water and good health care. So, you know, if they tell you you have a 50% greater chance of problem X, that doesn't mean that you're 50% more likely to get that problem. It just means that within the pool of people who are going to get that problem, if you are bottle feeding, you have a 50% higher chance. So that pool of people, we might be talking about 3 people out of a million. My feeling is if the differences were that clear, we would be seeing it on a population level. We would be seeing it on an individual level, and we're just not. So I do think that unfortunately we've allowed our exuberance about breastfeeding to really kind of sneak in to the science. And a lot of the researchers who are doing this work also are breastfeeding advocates. And to me, that's a big conflict of interest.
You talk in the book a lot about the argument of moral superiority when it comes to breastfeeding and the guilt trip that many mothers are put on. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that, especially as related to your own experience? I mean, what were the reactions you were getting from people when you came to the fact that you were going to have to bottle feed your son?
I think for me, because I had an excuse at the beginning, I used that excuse and I didn't get as much vitriol as I probably would have if I had just said, eh, it wasn't for me. So I think, you know, mostly I was met with pity. The pity was really difficult for me to deal with as somebody who didn't feel like I should be pitied. I mean, here I was with this beautiful child who was finally thriving and healthy and everything I wanted in life, and yet people were looking at me like him and me were something that should be, you know, felt sorry for. It's just, you know, that was really it was a very strange experience for me. And I do talk in the book about feeling like I had a scarlet letter, you know, like a big B on me or I guess F for formula feeding. And to hear comments like that really get under your skin, you know, and just, I think, contribute to feeling like you have to make up for it somehow and, you know, be this perfect mother in every other way to make up for the fact that you're not doing what every mother is supposed to give to their child as, you know, the gift of life.
I wonder if the breastfeeding debate is part of a larger cultural conversation we're having about what is motherhood and what is a good mother mm-hmm. versus a bad mother.
Absolutely, I think it is. And I think breastfeeding is sort of what it's all been focused around, that and work. You know, before the argument was always working mother versus stay-at-home mother. And I think that has faded. It's still there, but I think it's faded a little bit and now become how we're feeding them.
Well, Suzanne Barston, thank you so much for coming in and sharing Bottled Up with us.
Thanks for having me.
Suzanne Barston is the author of the book Bottled Up, How the Way We Feed Babies Has Come to Define Motherhood and Why It Shouldn't. She writes and edits for health and parenting publications and writes the blog Fearless Formula Feeder. She first spoke with Stephanie Lecce in May. Whether or not to breastfeed is only part of a larger debate for nursing mothers, we return with another flashpoint, whether breastfeeding in public places like restaurants is normal or taboo. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard about one woman's failed efforts to breastfeed her child and the sense of failure that engendered in her. In Wisconsin, there is a law that permits breastfeeding anywhere at any time, and that includes public places like on buses and in restaurants. But not everyone seems to be aware of that law. In June, a woman at a local restaurant was asked to stop breastfeeding her infant. Lake Effect's dining contributor Ann Christensen tells Dan Harmon that while that shouldn't have happened, there are ways to accommodate everyone's needs.
I just feel that if you do something, if you're nursing a child, you should be discreet about it. And I think not only for people around you, I would think for your own privacy and the baby's privacy. And I think about, you know, I have not had children, but I have family members who've had babies and breastfed, and they were always discreet about it. In fact, just covering up with a blanket, a lot of times you didn't even know that they were nursing the baby. It almost just looked like they were holding the baby. So I don't have a problem with it at all. I think probably just because you're in a public place, it would be prudent and respectful to yourself, to other people, to be discreet about it.
Or show some modesty.
Show some modesty. I was in a museum with my cousin who was breastfeeding her six-month-old in France in the Centre de Pompidou. She was sitting right in front of a big display of paintings and was nursing her baby. And people walked by, had no idea. Again, she was covered up.
Do you think, just being a dining critic, have you ever noticed this before? I mean, have you noticed either people doing it or people reacting to it?
No. I mean, first of all, I think, off the top of my head, I would say I can't really picture something from the past of sitting in a restaurant and seeing someone doing this. But I'm sure there have been people around me in casual settings in a restaurant that have done it and I had no idea, because maybe just the way they were sitting, again, they were sort of in a booth, maybe covering themselves up with a blanket, had the child carrier next to that. You know what I mean? There's all these ways that you can kind of barricade yourself a little bit so that people don't see you. I really doubt, I very seldom see people bring infants into higher end restaurants. I have never seen anything that even looked remotely like someone was nursing inside a high-end restaurant. You know, people don't really bring babies there. But this brings up something else, something that I saw on Twitter. It was from a New York magazine, or maybe it was the Village Voice. I can't remember who tweeted it, but it was a couple. There was a photo of a couple sitting outside on a patio at a restaurant. They brought a crib, their baby's crib, and put it right next to their table and had their kid in it, which I thought was really funny. Can you imagine that?
That's a whole nother interview.
That's a whole nother topic, right.
Well, I just find it's perfectly legal for women to breastfeed anywhere they want. So what I find interesting is that when I go out to eat, I mean, I wouldn't even know if the people two tables down from me even have clothes on, much less someone
really?
Breastfeeding. I mean, I don't care. I don't even notice. So it just seems like this person or the server who asked this woman to leave the restaurant is drawing way more attention to this than was even there to begin with. You know, I mean, who really notices? And maybe if you're at the table next to you, but even then, do you really notice people doing things like this?
I hope not.
And if I did, I wouldn't care.
Okay. But, you know, that's an interesting point that you raise. I don't know. I was not in this restaurant. I wasn't present when this was happening. But if it was really overt, maybe it was, and it was very obvious to people seated around that particular table, in which case I would say, show some more, some modesty, right? And don't make it perfectly obvious to everyone around you, because maybe unlike you, I think there are diners that look around. They're people watching. You know, they do pay attention to what's going on around them. They watch people. It's just what people do. You know, you're in a public setting. You know, but some diners, are like you. They just wouldn't even notice. And you're right. I mean, obviously, it's going to bring more attention to the situation by the server, you know, making some kind of a spectacle out of this and doing, you know, acting in an inappropriate way, whether, you know, asking them to leave or, you know, embarrassing these people in some way.
Well, it sounds like the owner of the restaurant did the right thing. And I thought it was a very gracious letter and put it out there that it was a mistake on the part of his employee and that he would never allow such a thing to happen, the person to be asked to leave.
And yet I think he had to address that, because that's a story that was going to get out there and he was going to get some major criticism for it. And rightly so, because this, again, there's no, you know, I mean, this is perfectly legal, as you say, to do that, to breastfeed in public. This is something that, you know, it's a state statute, you know, that guarantees the right to breastfeed. Right. So, I mean, I think he had to address it in some way. It's interesting that he went to Facebook to do it. That's definitely, it's a forum where, you know, you're going to get a peanut gallery of comments.
Mm-hmm. And he did.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and also the law states that for the purposes of the law, a restaurant is a public place, even though it's a privately owned
Correct.
Entity. So, yeah, that women are still allowed to breastfeed in restaurants. That's part of the law.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, if you don't mind, do you mind if I bring up something else that I saw on – there's a story on the internet actually about a woman in London who's like a mixed media artist, kind of a performance artist, something like this. And she created like a song about and kind of a performance based on having been shamed in public breastfeeding her child. And then what it drew was some kind of comments from women saying that they felt like because they were uncomfortable, they felt uncomfortable breastfeeding in public, that they somehow did not do right by their children to breastfeed them in public because they were too embarrassed to do it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so
wow.
They felt like, you know, it was somehow they, you know, this was something they had owed their child, but they, you know, they couldn't do it. So their child somehow, you know, suffered the consequences of not being breastfed in public.
All right. Well, what's your feel for how diners in Milwaukee feel about this? Do you want to speak for everyone here that goes out to eat? And just put in a, what do you think diners actually, does it vary by parts of town? Does it vary by the scale of the restaurant, that kind of thing?
Well, I've said that I have never seen anyone breastfeed in a high-end restaurant. I think there are situations, restaurants where you wouldn't bring a child, period. You know, and if you bring a baby, you know, I've occasionally seen it, a sleeping baby in a carrier that is in a booth or something, never wakes up. You almost never know unless you see someone carrying that child. I think there are places that just by the sake of them being very quiet, being very intimate, more for, you know, just the purpose of going to for a really nice meal. And maybe not having a lot of room for a woman to feel comfortable doing that. Maybe that's not the best place to bring a baby and breastfeed your child. However, I'm not saying that there isn't any place that you should be able to breastfeed in your child in public. You do. You have that right. But I think that it's up to you to do it in a way that's discreet and modest. Personally, I think that would be the way to do it. That is what I would do.
To me, the analogy is, well, you can bring your kids anywhere you want as well. I mean, that's
perfectly
at liberty to bring kids to any restaurant you want, but
it
doesn't mean that it's appropriate for every restaurant.
No, but, you know, the other thing about, you know, nursing a baby is, you know, this is not some new thing. Obviously, women have been nursing their babies since the beginning of time, and it's a very natural thing, I believe. It is not, you know, it's not unnatural. It is something completely natural, and I think a woman has every right, every woman, to nurse their baby. So I just think it's really interesting that this becomes a topic of debate, to be honest, because but people have opinions, and there are things that people don't want to see or feel like they should witness, you know? Mm.
Do you think people really are offended, or are they just choosing to be offended?
That's a good question. I think, you know, based on just this case alone, people sound like they're really offended by it. But we're not talking about an issue of quote unquote pornography. You know what I mean? We're not talking about witnessing, you know, some kind of indecent act in public. This is not an indecent act.
Right.
So it, to me, it's kind of ludicrous to be offended by it.
Do you sense any kind of ogre trend coming down the road of people just being really intolerant of various things?
You know, there's always going to be a contingent of the ogres. It's the same people. It's not the same people, but there are people that are going to say breastfeeding in public is wrong, bringing children into restaurants, they don't want to see that. They don't want to see dogs on patios sipping water or sitting in somebody's lap. You know, I mean, there's always going to be people like that. You know, it upsets their aesthetics, or they may argue that it interferes with their meal, although I don't know how, unless that child is right in their ear wailing or something. I don't know how, you know, it would interfere with the quality of their experience.
All right. Well, I'll just have to say that going out to dine is a very public experience. I mean, no matter where you are, people from all kinds of lifestyles, ages.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that just seems like part of the expectation when you go out to eat is that you're not going to be among people who think exactly like you. So some tolerance should be expected.
Of course. Of course. And yet people on the other end of that might say, yeah, but I'm going out and I'm spending my hard-earned cash and I should be able to have an experience where I'm not annoyed. you know, I'm not offended, or, you know, something around me isn't like, you know, I something isn't bothering me because I'm spending money in your restaurant. You know, this is my experience here, and this is interfering with that. I'm not saying that's a good argument. I mean, it's in my opinion, it's not, but that might be the sort of tack that someone is taking.
Seems like an unreasonable expectation.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I admit, of course, I get in those moods, and when I do, I get takeout food and go home and stay at home.
Maybe that's the solution. Then, you know, you can control your environment and your experience.
Pretty much.
There
yeah.
you go.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Anne. I'll talk to you next month.
Thank you.
Anne Christensen is senior editor of Milwaukee Magazine and Lake Effect's monthly dining contributor. She spoke with Dan Harmon. Coming up next, lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. Well, just a play called Tigers Be Still, actually. We'll learn more after a break. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. What do you get when you combine a jobless art therapy graduate, a kleptomaniac teenager with anger management issues, and a tiger on the loose? For the Boulevard Theater in Bayview, it's a summer comedy called Tigers Be Still that opens tonight. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon spoke with the Boulevard's artistic director, Mark Booker, and two of the four actors, Brooke Wagner and Josh Wallace, and Booker describes the play.
It's a Midwest premiere about a dysfunctional family. Two sisters, one of whom is a recent art therapy graduate, Sherry, who's trying to get a job and does, but finds out that her job is from her high school principal, whose son is a kleptomaniac and becomes her first patient. Meanwhile, her alcoholic, boozing, embittered sister, Grace, suffering from a recent breakup, refuses to leave the couch. Her catatonic, reclusive mother lives upstairs, and a tiger has recently escaped from the town zoo.
How are you going to accommodate a tiger in this?
Well, there's a secret way that I'm going to do it, and I ain't lying.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. It's a perfect summer comedy, Tigers Be Still at the Boulevard Theater, and it is a Midwest premiere. It's by Kim Rosenstock. It's got a great cast with Brooke Wagner as Grace and Josh Wallace as Zach. And then Shannon Tyburski as Sherry, who is – it's a lead role. It's a great role for her. And Jamie Jastrab as Mr. Moore, her kooky principal boss.
All right. And we have Brooke and Josh in the studio. Why don't you – I'll have you start, Brooke. Just tell us a little bit about your role.
Sure. I do play the role of Grace, who is an alcoholic and recovering from the breakup of her engagement with her fiancé. It's a great role. It's got a lot of comedy to it, and it's a different role for me. I've never played an alcoholic recovering from the breakup of a relationship, so it's a nice challenge.
Did you get to do any special research to learn how to become a boozer?
Well, I did draw on my college years. I won't lie.
All right. Josh, any special considerations for you? Which character are you playing again?
Hi, I'm Josh. I play Zach Moore. He is a 19-year-old kleptomaniac who, according to Sherry, is dealing with anger management issues. He works at CVS and starts taking art therapy lessons from her to get over his grieving after the death of his late mother, which occurred about a year ago.
Mark, you have something to say?
The only thing I wanted to say is it's a delightful comedy. I know that the issues that we were discussing, alcoholism, family grieving, healing, etc., they sound very dark. But Kim Rosenstock, the playwright, has whipped up kind of a souffle of a play, which it's so serious issues, but you're laughing at the same time. And I want to remind audiences that it ends happily, which is delightful. Most plays don't anymore.
Okay, well, you're going to do a reading, am I correct?
There are two monologues that are featured in this production. Josh Wallace plays Zach, and in the middle of the play, he describes his encounter with the escaped tiger. And then Brooke Wagner, who plays Grace, handles a phone call with her ex-boyfriend, Troy, who normally does not return her calls.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go.
Josh, you go first.
This is how it happens. I wait until my dad has gone into his room for the night, and then I grab the suitcase that's been sitting under my bed, packed, for months. Then I go to the kitchen to grab a box of cookies, and leaning up against the leg of the table, I see the rifle. And for the first time, it hits me. My dad has a rifle. And that's not okay. He needs someone to take it away. So I do that. I walk out of the house I've lived in my whole life with a rifle, most of my belongings, and a box of cookies. And I have no idea if I have the courage to go any further than the town pond, which is where I'm standing, looking at the ducks, when I hear it. A soft rumbling, a growling. And I turn around, and there it is, the tiger at the town pond. And I'm, like, armed, you know? And I think, I can be the guy that defended the town from the tiger. And I'm about to pull the trigger when everything just becomes really, really still. I stare into the tiger's big yellow eyes, and I swear it's like he wants me to shoot him. He's tired and alone and lost. And I think, yeah, sure, this tiger's dangerous. But, like, if you really think about it, who isn't? And he squints and stares at me in this sad, broken way. And in that moment, for him, I choose life. I slowly lower the gun, and as I do, the tiger glares at me like, oh, great, thanks for nothing, a-hole. And he just turns around and walks away. So then I'm just standing there thinking to myself, now what? When suddenly I drop the rifle and it goes off at my feet, and at the sound of the gunshot, I run. I run as fast as I can, suitcase and everything. I run until I'm at the bus station, and then I get on a bus, and then I get on another bus. And that's how I escape.
All right, now monologue number two. Do you want to set us up with this one, Burke?
Sure. This is Grace calling and leaving a message for her ex-fiancé, Troy. Oh, hey, Troy. It's Grace. I see you've decided not to pick up, which is actually perfect, because I'm just calling to say that I just wish that you from 4 years ago was here. Except I can't talk to that guy anymore, because in some twisted cosmic joke, that guy ended up turning into you. And you're like the biggest idiot of all time. Seriously, what the hell is wrong with you? I took so many things from the condo. I took the dogs. Do you really care more about not facing me than you do about your own dogs? What kind of person doesn't try to get his dogs back after his ex-girlfriend kidnaps them? That's really sick. Please continue to not contact me. Goodbye.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, Mark.
Mm-hmm, it is. The four characters are wacky, and yet they're so grounded in humanity. This is an excellent script, and we are thrilled to produce it at the Boulevard Theater.
I remember the last time I went to a Boulevard play, there was a dog involved.
Or, yes.
Did you find some chihuahuas in this case?
The chihuahuas are alluded to, and they are ensconced in a shopping bag of sorts. So we never really needed the live chihuahuas as we did for The Last Romance, which was a very successful play for us.
Okay. And what's the run for this play?
The run is the 31st of July through August 18th. Very limited performances, only 9 performances. It's really a delightful play. I would encourage everyone to rush out and catch a tiger by the tail and see a perfect summer comedy by seeing Tigers Be Still at the Boulevard Theater.
All right. Well, Mark, Brooke, and Josh, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Mark Booker is the artistic director of the Boulevard Theater. Josh Wallace and Brooke Wagner star in Tigers Be Still, which opens tonight and runs through August 18th. They spoke with Dan Harmon. There's more information about the play at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then catch up with singer-songwriter Jessie Teresi and her band, The Please Please Me, when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Welcome back. I'm Bonnie North. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. The last time Jesse Terese was on Lake Effect, the East Coast-based singer-songwriter was in search of a band. 2 years, a move to Austin, and many bandmates later, she has one. The Please Please Me is Terese, along with Elisa McClure on vocals and cello, and Augustine Frederick on vocals and percussion. They have a new EP out called Shake a Little Harder. The band will play 2 gigs in Milwaukee tonight, an acoustic set at Circle A, and then a late-night electric set at Lineman's. We caught up with them via Skype before they arrived in town, and Terese says the search for a band was all-consuming.
I feel like probably since I was last there 2 years ago, every day has been like, can I find a band? Okay, I have this great band. Can we figure out how to make something work that there's a cello as a main instrument instead of a bass and a drummer who has a really unusual kit and, oops, I guess I'm going to have to learn to play electric guitar because there's no guitarist in the band but me. So I feel like everything has been sort of pointing towards this EP and us really coming out into the world as a band since I was last there.
Now, how long have the three of you been the Please Please Me?
We're at about 1.5 years old, and this is Alyssa. I've been playing with Jesse for maybe 4 years at this point, but as a solid unit, the Please Please Me, we picked up Augustine from Craigslist. And from that point, we started making some really interesting magic, and so we're going to celebrate our two-year anniversary in December.
The sound on the EP is really quite amazing. Very lush for three of you.
I think a lot Augustine's prodding. I don't know if it's just our personalities or the fact that we both lived in New York City for a while, but we have a similar type of intensity. And so on that tour, when we essentially met, you know, there was this melding of the minds that's like, hey, if we grab the right other person, we could really do something special. And Augustine's worked as a sound engineer.
Well, so sometimes I have opportunity to work on shows in town, and that includes arena shows and
Paul McCartney.
Yeah, I got a chance to do sound for his crew and Taylor Swift, actually the day before, and
his guilty pleasure Katy Perry.
Yes, that was the year before too. So it's kind of fun. I'm a big fan of huge sound systems and big concerts, and it's something that drives me, and the whole physics of sound. And we've kind of taken a lot of that influence and applied it to us because we're such a small group, and everyone has been asked to do 3 or 4 things
above
what they're capable of doing. And that ability has allowed us to create this new sound.
And not only are you, you know, being asked to do more things, but you're being asked to do them live. Because this is all part of a live show. This is not just recorded where, you know, studio magic can make all kinds of things happen.
Yeah, but we don't believe in doing that. Because then people show up to the show and they see you for who you really are.
Yeah. So. The three of us kind of have a belief that the stage is a sacred place. And it's also a place where the bar exists, you know? And sometimes you can go out and get amazing recordings, and then you go see your favorite band, and it's like, what happened? So for us, it's like we're trying to make that the stage, that place where the magic is brought, and it happens there right in front of you, and it becomes an experience that involves the audience too.
She leaves notes every time she goes. On the back of my chest, she leaves dirty clothes. She leaves her fingerprints on my skin. Long black hair in my bathroom sink. She leaves a lipstick stain on my car. Make me think of her lips more than I want. She leaves something in my head.
And I sort of just want to explain, since it's radio and, you know, if you listen to an EP, you don't really know necessarily what people are doing, but I am the lead vocalist, and I play electric guitar, and originally I'm the drummer, so I also have a floor tom and this really cool African log drum that I picked up in my travels, and then Alyssa plays cello, but obviously we can't do anything the normal way, so Alyssa has an insane pedal board where she can make any sound from, you know, a spaceship taking off to the earth rumbling to an orchestra to a regular bass. And then Augustine's drum kit is like an octopus, I think. There's just things everywhere you look, including this huge glockenspiel and some electronic triggers, and everybody has to sing. So I would say if there's one problem we had, it's arguments in rehearsal about no, you sing. I can't sing right now. I'm busy.
Now that you've described what you do live with it, having just heard it, now I'm superimposing that, you know, in my head going, wow, that is going to be amazing.
Well, and one more thing to superimpose too that we've recently been able to cultivate is a couple of folks on stage dancing and singing with us. It's something that I really enjoyed getting to do because I feel like in this whole process of making music, we're trying to get people to also unleash with us and experience the words that we're saying, the emotions that we're trying to express. And so now this entire tour, we have every single time had folks join us on stage and dance to all of these songs. So go ahead and give yourself a little dancing crew behind us there on the stage in your mind as well.
I think for me, it's like you make a record and then you have to come up with a title and you have to just think, wait, what is it I'm really trying to say to the world? I started just listening to the lyrics in a new way. Shake a Little Harder really jumped out at me as this line that both means sort of dance party, but is also this metaphor for people really like freeing themselves and letting loose and being who they are. And we really try and create that on stage by making this just like really expressive, really sexual, really alive environment where everybody is invited.
And that comes in All Danced Out, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Also, some of the new songs that we have percolating right now. We're actually going to be back in the studio after the 19th to do EP number 2.
Will people here in Milwaukee hear some of those new songs that haven't been put out on EP yet?
Oh, absolutely. You guys are at this tour. Everybody is our guinea pigs. We have to make sure we really fine-tune those songs because we're going to record them as soon as we get home. And I think I'm really, really proud of the new songs because what's happened is that after playing together for a year and after recording this first EP, it's like, oh, well, now we kind of understand how we fit together, how these like unusual pieces work, and also understand the sounds that we're writing and arranging for. So in a way, I think the new songs, besides their kind of melodic and sophisticated in a different way, it was also able to think, all right, well, if we're all doing 10 things, how can we build a sense of like ease and relaxed into it, you know? And so they've been really, really fun to play on stage and live. And it's been super nice to hear the audience pick those songs out because they've never heard them before. So if they, after one listen, they get in there, that's a good sign.
Take me out in my red hat hands. Take me away from here. Working shoes. Now I got the working blues. I wanna go dancing. I wanna go dancing. Hey, hey, hey. I wanna go dancing. Take me, baby, shake me to my dance step.
Does this look like it's a bit more long-lived than some of the other permutations of the band? It sounds like you guys are really cooking with gas.
When I met Augustine was right about when I started to really reach this desperation point of like, I feel like I'm shortchanging myself and these songs because the sound is always changing. It's like whoever happens to show up, it's like they play like their style is instead of like we have a style and we have a sound. And, you know, and it's also hard to get tight when the cast is always changing. I try and explain to people, like, what if you went to the office every day and there were different people there? Like, the business wouldn't run that well, you know?
But it sounds like you've got a good team in place. The three of you sound very much like creatively as well as all other ways. You're working together very well.
Yeah, I mean, Augustine always says that most bands don't make it to the five-year mark. And it's certainly hard for bands to stay together, but I try and really just focus on what we can be if we keep going instead of, you know, are we famous now? Are we making money now? Is it working now? I just try and think about, wow, we're going to be amazing if we just keep going.
We also spend a lot of time working on our relationship, though.
There's
a lot of band time where I will read a passage out of a book that's meaningful to me, and we talk about it. We talk about our feelings and our you know, things that maybe have come up for us or behaviors that maybe are going on in the band. And we're very dedicated to trying to make this work on all levels. And that really comes out on the stage.
I think that's actually been one of our secrets, is it's more of like the focus on the human, the person.
Our friends that we make in the cities.
Yeah. And how we relate to one another and just respecting one another as people. And then when all that is in place, then that gives room for the music to happen. And that's been the nicest thing about this group, because now we can share that with our folks.
Well, you have a really solid foundation that you've built that then lets the music be free.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, why am I really, you know, sleeping on people's floors and risking getting in trouble at work and taking all the money I earn and, you know, we're throwing it back into the van or recording or all these things. And for me, the thing that drives me is I want to create something that's going to touch people on the deepest level. I mean, I think there's so much watered down and superficial about pop culture right now. And I think about, I want to make that music that somebody puts on a mixtape for a friend when they're getting married or going through a breakup or, you know, somebody close to them has died, like those songs that just stay with you forever. And I think in order to do that, you have to be that yourself. You know, you have to really be open to that kind of human connection and emotion. It's a very hard thing to fake. And so we try very hard to kind of walk the walk.
Yeah.
Well, and here's to many more years of you doing it.
Thanks.
Augustine, Jesse, and Alyssa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And I promise, no, I wouldn't answer, but the telephone rang. Ooh, and I swore I'd close the blinds when I saw you.
That's the Please Please Me with Exile from their new EP, Shake a Little Harder. The band are Jesse Terese, Augustine Frederick, and Alyssa McClure. They'll perform an acoustic set tonight at Circle A, followed by a full electric show at Linneman's later in the evening. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.